What if I told you that many of the artifacts that tell our nation's story have vanished? Our greatest historical treasures lost or stolen and then hawked on the black market. Now it is time to take back what is ours. I'm Mel Bradser. I've spent my life telling stories from history, and I'm asking for your help finding these objects. You could even earn a reward. Together, we can save our lost history. Johann Schmidt, member of Hitler's inner circle, head of Hydra, arch nemesis of Captain America, one of the greatest icons of American history. Say what you want about Schmidt, but he was one of the most important figures in World War II. According to Smithsonian expert Evelyn Cody,
the Red Skull, also originally known as Johann Schmidt, was a German-born physicist who was approached originally by Hitler due to Hitler's interest in the powers and weapons that Schmidt was attempting to create. He was later approached by the head of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, who put him in charge of weapons development for the SS. This was slightly separate from what Hitler was doing, but still within that same conquer the world party movement. While Hydra was the department that Schmidt ends up creating for himself, it was fully funded by the SS, but run by him, and it was totally separate from the SS and the Nazi Party. The Nazi Party was under the impression that Schmidt was working for them. He was realistically using them for money, power, funding, and lab rats, to be fair.
We also were able to contact the digital consciousness of Schmidt's right-hand man, Arnim Zola, which, despite Zola's death in 1972, amazingly lives on in an undisclosed server and reached out to us via the internet as we were researching for this episode. In his words,
Hydra began as a small group of individuals back in ancient Egypt. Our goal was to better the world, to make it more habitable, to make it more in line in the goals that we had. Essentially, we wanted to control the world for the betterment and for the good of all its people.
A group dedicated to world domination with roots dating back to ancient Egypt? Sounds like something out of a comic book. But you can't make this stuff up. An expert on Hydra who wished to remain anonymous told us more.
Like, Schmidt was, like, so smart. Like, he, like, literally, like, figured out things that we're, like, figuring out now. Like, I mean, like, the thing that he used, like, power all his weapons was, like, this, like, unknown, like, force. Like, we haven't even figured that out. Like, that's, like, some, like, Tony Stark next-gen shit that we just haven't come to yet. And, like, he was doing this way back then. He had, like, magic and crap.
In September 1935, Schmidt encountered biochemist Abraham Erskine, a meeting which would change both of their lives.
Erskine was like this dude who was like kind of smart. He's not kind of smart, he's like actually smart, but like not as smart as Schmidt because he didn't do anything with like what he was doing. Like he wasn't like using his knowledge to like do better things, but like Schmidt like focused him on like the priorities and like the important thing. And like, so like Schmidt like met like Erskine when like Erskine was like trying to leave Germany. And so, like, Erskine ended up having to stay with Schmidt to, like, help him. And, like, Schmidt, like, focused Erskine.
He, during his work in Hydra and in Germany, came across the work that Erskine was doing and, in short, kidnapped him and locked him up in his castle and demanded that he work on a formula that would make Schmidt a better man.
Apparently it was like not finished because Erskine wasn't that smart. And I guess he didn't tell Schmidt because like Schmidt ended up like using it on himself and like it didn't go like he thought it was gonna go. But he was still like, it still did what he wanted, but like just not exactly just what he wanted. It made him like a lot smarter than he already was. It made him like stronger, it made him faster, it made him better than like everyone else that was like around at the time, but it also melted his face off.
Erskine's formula, which would later become the super soldier serum, makes what's there better and what's worse, worse. Schmidt was evil and he looked like what he was on the inside.
He like lost his like skin and stuff. I mean, we just think it's his face. Hopefully it was just his face. We've never seen him naked. There's no proof that he had skin anyplace else, but we're just not gonna speculate on that because that's kind of weird and creepy. And let's move on to another topic.
For years, Schmidt wore a full facial prosthetic, including a wig, in order to hide his transformation. The prosthetic was destroyed in Schmidt's first confrontation with the good captain. But the wig attached to the prosthetic survived and could hold important genetic evidence about the mysterious leader of Hydra and why the serum affected him the way it did. And this hairpiece went through quite a journey before it was able to be recovered.
So Zola kept journals. He meticulously kept journals and notes and information that he had gathered over the years about Hydra and Hydra's work and the work that he was doing. He worshipped Schmidt. He truly believed Schmidt was going to be God, or was going to be a god. So according to Zola's own journals, he came into possession of Schmidt's hairpiece during a raid that Captain America led against Schmidt's stronghold. Schmidt ripped his face off, literally ripped his prosthetic face off and the hair, and threw them at Zola in a rant towards Captain America that Zola was witness to. And in the mad scramble to leave the facility that was burning and being destroyed both by Jonah Schmidt's own hand and by the SSR that was invading it, Zola just kept it.
And what did he use it for? It wasn't for genetic material, or even to study the fine workmanship. So what act of evil did Zola use the wig for? Well, it wasn't so much evil as it was strange.
There were brief passages in his journals in which he would confess, ashamed of himself almost, as if he was a schoolboy speaking to a Catholic priest, about how he would don Schmidt's wig, what was left of it, stand in his mirror and say kind words to himself as if Schmidt was saying it to him. It was a wildly unhealthy relationship that he had with an inanimate object.
Zola shared his own take on these events.
I did not compliment myself in the mirror. No, nothing so pedestrian such as that. I had wanted to elevate myself to quite possibly the most manly, striking, provoking figure that I had ever had the fortune of encountering. I took Schmidt's hairpiece and gave myself very masculine and manly affirmations, assuring myself of my rank, my superiority, and everything that I brought to Hydra as an organization.
This is during the time in which he had defected to the SSR after Captain America had taken down Schmidt, and Schmidt had vanished from history. We are not sure where Schmidt went, but Zola at this time was alone. He was in literal enemy hands, and so he apparently turned to the wig and what was left of his former boss, the man that he believed to be God, and he would use it to build his confidence up in rough situations. Zola spent the rest of his life in the bounds of the SSR, which would later become SHIELD. So in his death, all of his possessions became the possessions of the SSR and of SHIELD. And all of his scientific research was given to Howard Stark. Howard Stark had joined the SSR as initially a benefactor for funding and also for weapons design and support for the troops. So since Zola was also in weapons design for Hydra and then continued that work with the SSR, Howard Stark was the next obvious choice for all of his scientific research. So with Zola deceased and all of his possessions divvied up between the SSR and Howard Stark. Somehow, either by misfiling, by mislabeling, the hairpiece ended up in the science department of Stark Industries, and therefore in the possession of Howard Stark.
And what did Howard Stark do with Schmidt's hairpiece? Our research strongly suggests that he used it. You heard right. Used it. We can't pinpoint the exact reason why, but we have been able to piece together that at one point Mr. Stark was involved in a weapons development accident that burned away much of the hair on his face and head. We reached out to Natalie Rushman from Stark Industries to learn more.
Stark Industry has no comment.
An unfortunate dead end. However, we were able to get in touch with Howard Stark's hairdresser, Lauren D'Onofrio from the Lemon Tree, who was able to tell us more.
Howard Stark. Well, okay. He was a great zipper. He was really, really surprisingly into skincare, especially for one of the more manly men, which is usually, like, we get mud masks and things like that for, you know, they're more of a bridal shower kind of thing. They're not really like man's day out, especially before the term metrosexual was a thing. So, you know, you don't say anything because the guy's tipping 300%, but when a guy who comes into your salon and he's like, yeah, I want some sparkly purple nail polish, you're like, yeah, I remember that. I remember that. He'd come in, like, once every couple months. But when he came in for the whole day. It was, like, a whole big ordeal. It was amazing. And, yeah, a good 10 years after he started showing up on the regular, he was like, no, don't touch my hair. And I was like, all right, you're paying. Whatever. His eyebrows were very trimmed. Mom might say non-existent. One might say singed. One might not say that if they wanted their 300% tip, you know, they'd just say it was an experimental look. It makes sense. He was an engineer. He was always under the cars, you know, whatever.
We showed her Schmidt's recovered hairpiece to ask if she could identify it as Stark's.
Look, okay, it's like doctor-patient confidentiality. It's like hairdresser-hairdressee confidentiality, so I can't 100% sure say that Howard Stark were awake, because then, like, why would he be coming to my salon? But that is a remarkably well-preserved hairpiece, and it looks very, very similar to the ads for the Stark Expo in 1974, and that is all I'm saying about the subject.
Following the interview, experts compared Schmidt's hairpiece to promotional footage from the 1974 Stark Expo. It was a perfect match. Again, we reached out to Stark Industries for comment.
Stark Industry has no comment.
But when we shared the hairpiece's origins with Miss D'Onofrio, she wasn't the least bit surprised.
Huh. You know, I could see that. I could see Howard Stark wearing somebody else's hairpiece if it was like, this guy is the guy.
Shocking, right? A priceless piece of history almost certainly sat on the head of one of America's greatest innovators for years before his death. Where the wig turned up next was also surprising.
Given the semi-recent events that occurred in Washington with the discovery of the infiltration of Hydra into S.H.I.E.L.D. and then the subsequent dump of all of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s files, one of our interns searched through the database for information about things related to our Captain America's exhibit and discovered that in a locked box in a possession in with a set of other miscellaneous items from various deceased people, we confirmed that this was in fact the hairpiece that belonged to Johann Schmidt.
But how did it turn up there? When I realized the implications, it shook me to my core.
I heard this from Susan, which, you know, whatever, Susan. But I heard that when they found the body, they couldn't totally identify who it was because the body was bald.
Hydra needed like proof and stuff, and so like they would like request like their agents would like bring back like, yeah, I guess we'd call them trophies or whatever, of like their victims. Not like fingers or ears or like teeth or like eyeballs, like nothing like that, but like just proof of like death, I guess. And so like they have like a weird collection of like just stuff that they had from people that they killed.
So this means that it wasn't a car accident that killed Howard and Maria Stark. It was Hydra. The extent to which Hydra infiltrated our government and shaped our history is sickening, and we would never have known if it wasn't for artifacts like this. After the wig was found, it was taken to a secure facility, where we have our best and brightest currently working on looking for more information that this artifact might hold. Government officials have stated that once the testing is done, it will be placed in the Captain America exhibit in the Smithsonian, to the great relief of myself and other historians. After Dr. Abraham Erskine's murder and the inadvertent destruction of the last remaining vial of the super soldier serum that created Captain America's impressive physique, several vials of blood were taken from the only successful test subject of the serum in an attempt to reverse engineer the formula. The test subject? Private Steve Rogers, the man who would later become one of the greatest icons of our nation, Captain America. The serum transformed a small, fragile young man with a myriad of health problems into a healthy, broad-shouldered, Nazi-killing badass. So you can imagine why the United States government wanted to reproduce this serum. So they could have an entire army of super soldiers to turn the tide against the threat of Hitler and Hydra. Dr. Erskine, the brilliant mind behind the serum, was killed shortly after the successful procedure that produced Captain America. A Hydra spy managed to sneak into the viewing of the experiment, shoot Dr. Erskine, and escape with the last remaining vial of the serum. However, Steve Rogers heroically pursued this Hydra agent, barefoot, through the streets of Brooklyn.
When that Hydra agent just took off, I wasn't really thinking very clearly. I just went right after him. I guess you could say there was a bit of an adrenaline rush. The Lucky Stark Cab Company still hasn't forgiven me for what I did to their cab. And it was just, a lot of it's a blur. I was discombobulated, I suppose is the word for it. Didn't know how to control my own body. Didn't know where my limbs were. Wasn't so great at corners.
Still has trouble with corners.
Shut up. I was running on instinct. I was, get that back. Get him. He jumped into his submarine. I dove after him. He was getting away with the last vial of the super serum that Dr. Erskine had put his life into. So I went after him. Punched through the glass. Because, hey, that was a thing I could do now. And, again, really wasn't thinking. It was mostly instinct. 90% instinct and 10% my pants, but pulled him out of the submarine, pulled him out of the river. He went for his gun. I punched him. The vial broke. That was the last of the super serum, the last bit of Dr. Erskine's life's work.
And the agent? Committed suicide via a cyanide capsule hidden in his back molar. What happened next? Was Dr. Erskine's miracle serum lost forever?
While most of the SSR did go overseas and do most of their work in a more intelligence-gathering direction, they didn't fully abandon the Super Soldier Serum project. In fact, after Agent Carter got done yelling at me for blocking her shot, the SSR basically had me strapped down to a bed and started sticking me full of needles. They must have taken a good 12 vials worth of blood. I swear I saw more needles that day than I did any time in my entire childhood.
And he got sick a lot.
Shut up, Buck.
Erskine was very secretive with his notes because he did not believe that this was something that everyone should have. He was not in this for... He had never went into the discovery of the Super Soldier Serum with the intent of creating an army. That was never his goal. In fact, he only continued his work because Johann Schmidt had had his own, and he thought that... He believed that the Allied powers needed their own Super Soldier in order to combat Schmidt. So the 12 vials of blood that were taken from Steve Rogers were taken because this was the only... This is the last remaining traces of it. And they were taken directly after. It was in case there were any changes. So the 12 vials of blood were taken on the orders of Colonel Phillips, who was the head, the only head, actually, of the SSR.
But did the government hold on to all those vials? They didn't. Government officials were determined to make sure that we were able to have the serum, so they distributed the large majority of the vials to several universities around the country.
The SSR decided that it would be prudent to send the vials of blood to various other universities and other scientific bodies to study. They kept, however, four of them because Howard Stark, who was part of the SSR, worked closely with Erskine, and they believed he was smart enough to hopefully figure out, at least from his side of the work, what Erskine had done. So four of the vials of blood stayed with the SSR and Howard Stark. Two of them went to Culver University. Two of them went to SUNY Hagman in New York. Two more went to City College, also in New York. And the final two vials went to Stanford University in California.
However, the war ended before the universities and the government had the chance to recreate the serum. So what happened to these vials? They sat in these buildings for years until SHIELD attempted to take back the vials and discovered that every single one of them had gone missing. We began our investigation into this mysterious disappearance by reaching out to Stark Industries. Howard Stark was responsible for creating the Vitaray machine that was instrumental in the process of creating the Super Soldier Serum. As a result, Stark Industries was heavily involved in the attempt to recreate the serum. We contacted them to ask if they had heard of the latest location of any of these vials.
Stark Industry has no comment.
We next attempted to contact Bruce Banner, a highly regarded physicist from Culver University. We know that Dr. Banner was spearheading a project to recreate the serum, so he may know what might have happened to the samples that were given to Culver. Unfortunately, we were unable to reach him.
Dr. Banner is currently unavailable for comment. To get in contact with Dr. Banner, please leave a message with Natalie Rushman of Stark Industries.
Leaving a message with Ms. Rushman didn't illuminate much.
Stark Industry has no comment.
Thank you, Ms. Rushman. Your assistance has been invaluable. But we were able to get in contact with one of the interns of the project that Dr. Banner headed, Carly Ackerman.
After the vials were donated to the university, we had, from what I had heard, we had initially ran a couple of tests when they were first given to us back in the 40s. As the vials were not recalled by the United States government, we ran a couple more tests from them, I believe in the 60s. That was the last time we had touched the blood itself. Now, sometime later, I believe it might have been the 70s or 80s, there was an anonymous donor that had gifted the school with a quietly frightening amount of money in exchange for the vials. From what I understand, the university felt that was struggling at the time, so the compromise for the vials, it seems like a fairly good deal for them. From what I've heard, the donor was a man who was completely hairless. I mean, this man didn't even have eyelashes from what I heard. Dr. Banner was able to continue his work on the Super Soldier Project with, from the information that was given to him via the results from the analysis run from the vials of blood in the 60s. Of course, the analysis it would have been better to have a more recent analysis. He was running off incomplete data. and that may have led to his decision to use gamma rays to recreate the effects of the serum, thereby leading to his quite unfortunate condition.
When Professor Emeritus Doris Fairchild at SUNY Hegman spoke to us about their vials, the story sounded suspiciously familiar.
Our vials of blood at SUNY Hegman were bought at the same time against my personal wishes, but by a decision made by the board that run this ran the school, that they preferred the money over the research that we were doing because we weren't getting any far in almost 20 years of research. We were too slow. We weren't working fast enough, and it was very, very expensive. It was very expensive. And so a woman, tall woman, beautiful, beautiful. I remember she had these gorgeous nails, sparkly purple glitter. She expressed interest in buying them. She came by the department once, just once. I saw her and convinced the chair, my boss, that it was in their benefit to allow her to purchase the vials. And he let it happen.
In fact, when we reached out to the various universities that the vials went to, we came across similar stories at every one. Individuals who all expressed interest in giving these struggling schools large amounts of money for just one thing in return. The vials of blood.
In a continuation of the Smithsonian's attempt to build a better Captain America, Howling Commandos, World War II exhibit, we reached out to several universities. Not that we at the Smithsonian would ever keep vials of human blood in our own exhibit, but we reached out of curiosity. So when we reached out to several of the schools, one staffer at City College in New York told us that she had been told by a professor that when the school was in financial strains, that a tall, mustached British man purchased from the school for an undisclosed amount of money one of the vials of blood. The second vial of blood was bought also anonymously by an Italian woman.
A bald man, a British man, an Italian woman, and a beautiful woman with purple nails. Coincidence seems unlikely here. It's more probable that these individuals were all part of the same group. But what's the connection? For what purpose did they buy the blood? Who could have been responsible for buying up every remaining trace of this important government research project? Russian spies? Hydra? We just don't know. But I want to find out. You can help. If you've heard anything or seen anything that can point us to the location of these vials, go on our website and submit a tip. Who knows? You might be responsible for bringing back a piece of our lost history. Steve Rogers' blood wasn't the only artifact of his that has been lost to history. When he was excavated from the airplane that he crashed in order to save our nation, SHIELD officials noticed another thing missing. One of his dog tags. What's the significance of this missing item? Here's Captain American historian Piper Selby on the importance of dog tags.
Dog tags are issued by the United States military as a form of identification for soldiers during combat. They were a quick way of determining name, rank, and blood type for injured soldiers. In the case of a soldier that died during battle, they also had a religion indicated so that we would know what kind of service to provide. Each soldier was given two, so in case the body could not be transported off the battlefield, there was a way to identify the body when medical help arrived. Soldiers were never supposed to take off their dog tags. They were supposed to remain on them at all times.
Official reports state that Captain Rogers was only found with one ID tag, which is still in his possession. but he should have had two. And here's the thing. During the war, the captain had never taken either of them off.
Oh no, you did not take off your dog tags. You hear stories about so-and-so traded with somebody else and then their family members got a condolence letter and then they came home the next day and it turned out their buddy was the one who had died. But we didn't do that. The 107th was on the front lines against Hydra, and Hydra had weapons that disintegrated you where you stood, and all that was left was your boots and your tags. And if you wanted your loved ones back home to know what had happened to you, you kept your tags on. No, I never took my tags off.
So what happened to this missing tag? Luckily, an unexpected source helped us trace the journey of this amazing piece of history. When Captain Rogers graciously agreed to sit down to tell his side of the story, he wasn't alone.
Excuse me, who are you, sir?
I'm part of Captain Rogers' security detail.
Seriously?
You are a national icon, sir.
And that security detail? None other than Sergeant James Buchanan Barnes, thought to have been the only casualty of the Howling Commandos. After his fall, Sergeant Barnes was captured by Hydra once again, subjected to a truly horrifying amount of medical experimentation at the hands of Hydra scientists. And through the subsequent decades under Hydra captivity, Sergeant Barnes did what any brave soldier would do. He fought against their brainwashing.
I had periods where I wasn't always under Hydra's control. Sometimes I had periods where I was really more myself than the weapon they'd created. Sometimes I would just be overcome with memories. I didn't know what they were or what they meant to me. A couple years ago, I think it might have been in the 70s, I remember wanting to go back to Brooklyn. I don't know why, but I remember squatting in this rundown apartment, living there, looking for something, but I don't know what it was.
Our anonymous Hydra expert explained more.
So, like, I was, like, looking at, like, the documents that they had, like, kept on, like, the stuff that they were doing and, like, the Winter Soldier product that they had. So, like, the technology that they were using, because, like, Smith wasn't, like, around to, like, handhold them through all of this, and, like, Zola had, like, defected to, like, the enemy or whatever, they didn't really, like, have this, like, 100%, like, in control, and they didn't quite know what they were doing all the time, so, like, sometimes the, like, commands just weren't, like, working all the time, and so he would, like, wander off and do other stuff if they didn't, like, wrangle him, so he, like, had, like, a closely guarded, handler who would, like, track him and make sure he, like, did his job, but he was, like, really, really good, and, like, his training was, like, way better than anything his handler could ever have done, so sometimes he would, like, lose his handler and, like, go and do stuff. There's, like, a report, like, from, like, from Hydra, from, like, the time that he, like, had to go kill someone in, like, New York, and he ended up, like, wandering around in, like, Brooklyn, because apparently that's where he goes when he comes to New York. They have, like, mentions of times, like, he was, like, lucid, but, like, not, like, fully lucid. Like, he would, like, not, like, remember, like, 100% what was going on, but, like, definitely more than they wanted him to be remembering. So, like, the longer he was gone, like, the longer he would, like, the more he would, like, remember, like, what was happening when he was necessarily, when he was, like, gone or whatever. And sometimes, like, other stuff. And, like, so there was a point where he was, like, gone for, like, a really, really long time. And, like, they never found out, like, where he went and, like, what he did or whatever. He was just, like, gone. He was, like, missing for, like, a week or two, which is, like, a way long time, because, like, Hydra's, like, everywhere, and, like, they have, like, eyes everywhere, so for them to, like, not find him, it's like, dude, where did you go? Like, where could you be?
And luckily, we were able to find out what happened during those 2 weeks straight from the horse's mouth, and in the process, find out who stole the dog tag in the first place. I was prepared to get angry about what had happened. Furious that anyone would steal an item of great historic value from one of our greatest icons. But when I found out the truth, I was filled with sympathy instead.
A couple years ago, I don't exactly remember when, but I remember being in a room full of pictures of Steve, posters, dolls, comics, all that shit. I don't exactly remember what my mission was, who it was, but I remember coming across some piece of a newspaper or something like that, and finding out that Steve didn't make it. And at this point, I was just consumed in trying to find him. After I managed to track down the site, I think, where Steve went down in the plane. And I remember seeing him just sitting there in that chair, and I knew I couldn't help him. I couldn't get him out of that place. I couldn't bury him. So I took one of his tags just so I could tell someone that he's somewhere. He's not lost.
It's a heartbreaking story, especially considering what happens next.
They, like, found him, like, in, like, Norway, dude. Like, Norway, which is, like, really weird. But, like, Hydra had, like, agents there, and they, like, found him, and they, like, saw him, and they, like, grabbed him, and, like, they, like, threw him in, like, the back of a van, basically, and, like, got him back to where he belonged.
I kept it on me. I knew that I couldn't let anybody see it, or else it'd be taken away from me, and I don't know what they would do with it. Maybe they tried to track Steve down and use his body for experiments or something like that. I didn't want to disrespect his body that way. So I kept it on me.
And, like, when they got him back or whatever, they, like, put him on ice for, like, a super long time. Like, way longer than they usually did. Because they had to, like, redo their entire, like, method. Like, they were like, okay, like, that wasn't working. Let's, like, try something new. And, like, but none of them, like, really knew what they were doing because, like, Zola wasn't there. Smith was gone. And, like, this is not, like, your standard operating procedure. This is, like, poke holes in your brain and electrocute it till we get it to, like, do what we want.
Sometime after, I don't remember when. I think I went back to New York to try to find Stark. Tony, I think. And because I knew he'd be able to find Steve and at the very least give him the proper funeral he deserved. So I went back. I think he was the one with the Captain America room, actually. Which is weird.
When we followed up on this story with Stark Industries, we were saddened to hear that Natalie Rushman, our point of contact thus far, was unavailable. We here at Lost History extend our best wishes and hope that Miss Rushman has a quick and full recovery from her illness. Oddly enough, the same day that Miss Rushman was absent, Stark Industries was finally available for comment. We were in fact able to speak directly with Mr. Tony Stark himself. We relayed to him Sergeant Barnes' story and asked whether the sergeant had ever managed to pass along the location of Captain Rogers' body when he sought Stark out 15 years prior.
15 years ago, I was drunk out of my mind at MIT. I never in my life saw that man before Captain America decided it'd be a great idea to take him home with him. So no, I do not remember him telling me this, and I'm sure he didn't. In fact, I am positive, I'm willing to bet the fortune that I have spent my life building up, and he, like so many other people, like Steve Rogers, does on a regular basis, confused me with my father.
But where did the tag end up? With the help of Sergeant Barnes's account, we were able to verify that the tag had indeed been in Howard Stark's possession. And what happened to it after the death of Howard Stark? It was sold off as part of his estate sale. You heard right, folks. Sold off in between comic books and Captain America action figures was the actual dog tag of Steve Rogers, auctioned where any schmuck with enough cash could snap it up.
After Howard Stark's death, his son held an estate sale to raise money for the Maria Stark Foundation, which is still maintained today by Stark Industries. We do have records that a dog tag, which we originally thought was a replica, was sold off during the estate sales.
And yet, it never crossed anyone's mind that the tag could have been the genuine article. but why would it? At the time, Captain Steve Rogers was believed to be missing in action. His body was missing, so there was no way that anyone could have believed that this was the real deal. Our Captain America expert gives us another reason.
We originally assumed that it was a replica because of all the memorabilia that was part of Howard Stark's collection. There were a lot of comic books, a lot of toys, a lot of sort of knickknacks that were sold off in the convenience store that an avid collector would have. It wasn't unusual that he would have a replica of a dog tag in amongst his collection.
My father's connection to Steve Rogers was he put him ahead of everyone else in his life. He ruined relationships with myself and with my mother, trying to find a dead man, a long dead man, who he would never find. He built a creepy stalker room in the honor of Steve Rogers that I had the unfortunate memory as a child of finding.
Tony Stark told us about his experiences with the room where his father's Captain America artifacts were kept.
There was a life-size photo of Captain America in full uniform, front and center in this room. There was a replica copy of his uniform hanging out there in a glass case. There were sketchbooks, notebooks, posters, anything and everything that Howard Stark could get his little grubby hands on in that room. It's probably worth billions of dollars.
As for the strangest thing he ever found there?
Let's just go with, I am glad that all my shots were up to date.
We didn't question further. But if Sergeant Barnes returned the tag to Howard Stark, why didn't he notice it among his carefully curated collection of Captain America memorabilia? That's because of the reason for Sergeant Barnes's return to Howard Stark's mansion. He was sent by Hydra with the programming to end Howard Stark's life that day.
They still had Winter Soldier. After they like revamped their entire like situation, like kill Howard Stark, and it totally worked this time, way better than it worked the last time, as he was dead this time.
I was contracted to kill Stark. And for a long period of time, I was able to just be the weapon, the asset. But towards the end, I think I realized what I was doing. So I left the tag with him, hoping that whoever found Howard would know that this was Steve's and be able to find him too.
With Howard Stark gone, there was nobody to notice the tag's mysterious appearance, or suspect that the tag might be genuine. So when the decision was made to sell off his extensive Captain America collection, it was rounded up with the rest of the collectibles.
Stark Industries did not keep records of the buyers in the estate sale.
But you never know how a story will turn out once you start unraveling the mystery. During the course of our investigation, we were able to track down the tag. Shortly after the first previews for this episode were aired, we received a call from a young man in Queens who was gifted this tag as a small child. Once he realized what he possessed, he was all too happy to give it back to its rightful owner.
Wow. Wow. I never expected to see this again. Wow. Thanks.
And that right there, that's why I do this. There is no way I can accurately describe how good it feels to return these priceless artifacts to where they belong. And you can help. Do you have an idea of where the lost artifacts in this episode or previous episodes may be? Maybe you heard a story from a neighbor or saw something somewhere it shouldn't be. Your tips could earn you up to $10,000 if they lead directly to the lost artifact in question. I'm Mel Bradser, and this has been Lost History. We'll be right back. Now, this isn't the end of the show. During the course of our interviews with Captain Rogers and Sergeant Barnes, we managed to obtain some incidental footage that was too precious not to share. Enjoy, folks.
Wow. I didn't think I'd see this again. Thanks, Buck. Here, you know what? Hold on to this in case you forget me.
As if I could forget the punk from Brooklyn I've been looking after all my life.
Hey, I was able to look after myself.
Yeah, that's why Arnie Porter beat the living snot out of you in the alley by our apartment.
I had him on the ropes.
Sure, buddy.
No, Buck, I want you to have this.
What do I need this for? I got you right here. I'm not letting you out of my sight again, you schmuck. I'm here with you till the end of the line.
Just in case there are any detours along the way, I want you to always be able to find your way home.
Hey, get off of me, you big lug. Told you I'd take you to see the future.
This has been Lost History, Captain America Edition, created by KLB as your host, Mel Bradser, Rena Jenkins as Howard Stark's hairdresser, Lauren D'Onofrio, and Steve Rogers, Lil Red Alchemist as Smithsonian expert Evelyn Cody, anonymous teen Hydra expert, Professor Emeritus Doris Fairchild, and Tony Stark, and Prixis as Natalie Rushman, the digitalized consciousness of Arnim Zola, Culver intern Carly Ackerman, Captain American historian Piper Selby, and Bucky Barnes. This is a work of fan fiction and is not affiliated with the actual show Lost History, although we do think the show is awesome and totally recommend you check it out if you liked this. Thank you for listening.